Yoga students, if you love to learn about yoga health and wellness, plant-based nutrition, flexibility, and mind-body biohacking, you have come to the right place, my friend. Welcome to the Yoga Talk Show with Lucas Rockwood, where my goal is to make your yoga practice just that much easier. Find us online at yogabodynaturals.com. We're also on Facebook and YouTube. Check us out. Now, let's get on with the show. So hello and welcome everyone, Lucas Rockwood here with the Yoga Talk Show. Thanks for tuning in. Today I've got with me Paul Turner, the food yogi. Paul, thanks for joining us.
You're most welcome, Lucas.
So Paul is called the food yogi and he's the international director of Food for Life and the co-founder of Food for Life Global, which is the world headquarters for this charity. Food for Life is the largest plant-based food relief organization in the world with projects in over 50 countries that serve up to 2 million meals daily, which is just really kind of mind-blowing. Paul is originally from Australia, and we're excited to talk about food, plant-based nutrition, and charity today. So, Paul, you're called the food yogi. What does that mean to you?
Well, it's coming from, you know, I was actually a monk for 14 years, so during that time, I really dove deep into the whole science and tradition of yoga. And I learned the importance of, becoming more conscious of everything we do in life. And one of the things which we all do, which we can all agree on, is that we have to eat. We may have different opinions on so many things, but when it comes to food, it's like, you know, we all have to eat three meals a day or so. So food yoga is really the art and science of learning to connect with food, have more gratitude for the blessing of food. And to understand that food really is a blessing and that it's not something that you can simply create, but really the ingredients that make up the food are a blessing from the divine. So to become aware of that, to learn to connect to the divine using food, and essentially that is really one of the main objectives of the charity that I direct, Food for Life Global.
So I'm really, really impressed with your charity work. With my company, we're always trying to find new charity projects and things to start. We're always trying to do things locally, especially. Mm-hmm. And, it's one of those things that it's hard to do, you know, and I never understood why, like, Bill and Melinda Gates start these big organizations. And I realized that, you know, the business of giving is a business in and of itself. And so, it's something that I've really been impressed by with your work. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about your work and, the things that you're doing to feed all these people.
Yeah, it's a big challenge. You know, the program started back in 1974. And during that time, it was really just a village program. The project started in West Bengal in India when some yoga students responded to feeding some local village children. And so then the program organically developed around the world. I got involved around 1983, so soon, you know, early in the development of the program, and I was a volunteer. And what's really special about Food for Life Global, or the Food for Life Project, is that it's a revival of a very ancient tradition of spiritual hospitality. And what that means is that in India, it's very common knowledge, even, you know, the street sweeper understands the science or the logic behind reincarnation and that there's more to our life than simply this physical existence. So in that respect, there's a sort of a common acceptance that we're all spiritually brothers and sisters. There's spiritual equality among all beings. And, of course, when we look at the Bhagavad Gita, which is considered to be really the essence of the yoga tradition, the Bhagavad Gita clearly states that, you know, a wise person understands the spiritual equality of all beings. So with this understanding, this Vedic culture or Indian culture of spiritual hospitality is a way to express that understanding, to express that belief that we're all spiritually equal by sharing food. And so the Food for Life program, its actual mission is to unite the world through pure food. Now, what's really amazing about that is that although that's our objective, we've also become the world's largest food distribution program. In fact, we've eclipsed even the World Food Program, the United Nations program. The United Nations serves about 90 million meals a year, which is really amazing. Of course, they distribute large quantities of of grain around the world, but in terms of prepared meals, they do about 90 million meals a year. Food for Life and its affiliates does about 90 million meals every 3 months. So we're actually like 3 to 4 times larger than the World Food Program. And it's quite amazing how it's evolved. And, of course, it couldn't have happened without a lot of volunteers giving their time and their passion to make the program a reality. And, of course, this idea that food can actually communicate a message of spiritual equality, that food does have the power to speak all languages, to communicate, to break down all barriers. And I believe that really sets Food for Life apart from other charities, is that we have this spiritual understanding without being sectarian.
And so just on a practical level, how is this happening? Do you have, food banks? Are you working with local temples? Are you working? How are these people actually getting fed?
Well, we have our biggest programs are in India, and we have these very sophisticated kitchens in pretty much all the major cities of India. And those kitchens will start at 1 o'clock in the morning. People will be in there preparing, cutting the vegetables and so on. And one kitchen alone will make it enough food to feed 60 to 70,000 children. And then once those meals are prepared in these very big pressure cookers, and we usually would cook a vegetarian stew, a vegan stew, which is sprouted rice or sprouted mung dal or something like that with lots of local vegetables. It's all local food. And then that food is portions of that food are put into stainless steel containers. Those stainless steel containers are then sealed, and then they're loaded onto trucks, hundreds of trucks. Those trucks visit schools around the local area, and they drop off the meals to the schools, and then the teachers feed the kids. And that goes on every single school day. And we're doing at least 2 million meals just in India alone, which is quite amazing. And,
wow.
And they're very sophisticated kitchens. I mean, the way we produce the food is just, mind-boggling. We even have these machines we've got custom built, and they make one machine will make 40,000 chapatis in 1 hour. So you literally, the volunteers will put the flour and the water in one end, and then out the other end, an hour later, is 40,000 chapatis, hot chapatis coming off the hot plate. It's quite amazing.
Wow. So, I mean, just the sheer volume. I mean, how big is a kitchen that can serve 60,000 people? Like, how big is this? Is that, in terms of square foot or square meters?
Well, that's another.
Is it a huge, huge warehouse kind of thing?
Actually, it's not that big. Some of them actually aren't that big. We have one kitchen in the Bombay district. And it's only 1,200 square feet. And in that 1,200 square feet area, it's divided into 4 sections. So 1/4 of that space is used for cutting the vegetables, preparing the actual vegetables and the rice and so on for the cooking. 1/4 is used for storing the grains and storing the spices. 1/4 is used for cleaning the pots. And only 1/4, which is 300 square feet, is preparing the actual food. And in that one kitchen, they make 65,000 meals a day.
That is unbelievable. And I had no idea that a kitchen that size could do that kind of productivity. Well, and it certainly makes me rethink, ending world hunger and things like this,
Yeah, well, it just goes to show you that, with a little bit of innovation and, enthusiasm, you can do amazing things with very little, very little space, very little resources. Another interesting thing about the Food for Life program is that we can feed people for very little money, a lot of people for very little money. On average, our programs in India can serve a complete meal to one child for as little as 10 to 15 cents. And that's, that's unheard of in the food industry.
Amazing.
And that includes paying for all the food, paying for the fuel, the gas, the security, the transportation, everything. The final cost of the meal is about 15 cents. So that means for someone donating $1 to Food for Life and its affiliates, you can guarantee we can serve at least 5 people, 5 kids with that $1, which is unbelievable. No one can do that. No one else that I know of, no other charity that I know of can actually do that.
That's incredible. And what does the staff look like? So when you talk about that one small facility, like are staff working there around the clock, or they come in the middle of the night, like you said, or how does that look?
Well, some of the more sophisticated kitchens, they'll have, you know, they have security. It's, you know, it's a big operation. So they will have people staying there. But usually the kitchen starts around 1 to 2 o'clock in the morning. And some people will come in and they'll start preparing all the vegetables, and cleaning and cutting and so on. And then around about 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, they'll start cooking. And then by 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, all the cooking is finished. And then between 10 o'clock and say 12 o'clock, the food is distributed to the schools. And then
incredible, absolutely incredible.
Yeah, then the trucks come back with the empty containers. They're cleaned. And then, you know, the kitchen's all cleaned and washed down and everything for the next day's cooking.
Wow. I'd love to see that someday. Sounds incredible. So, you know, I want to kind of jump topics here. From what I understand, you mentioned you'd been a monk for 14 years. And I know for people listening to this, whether they're into yoga or not into yoga, that's intimidating for people. And, that kind of makes people, you know, draw their head back and go, whoa. So I'm curious, you know, what are things that people don't realize about monastic life that make it easier than we think, and what are some of the things that make it more difficult? Maybe you can kind of shed some light on this, because I know for a lot of people it's just this kind of these other people doing this thing over here.
Yeah, a lot of people have this idea that, you know, to be a monk means you have to renounce the world completely and live in a cave or something like that. It doesn't necessarily mean that. Yeah, you could do that if you want, but really you have to understand what the meaning of renunciation is. Not to actually simply artificially renounce something and then harbor sort of these desires, you know, attachments. Real renunciation means, first of all, understanding who that thing or who actually owns that thing. For example, say you have a car, or say you have a plot of land, and you say, well, I'm going to become a monk, I'm going to renounce this land, I'm going to just give it away to charity. First of all, that land essentially doesn't really belong to you, because before you were even born, someone else owned that land. So who owns the land really? God owns the land, or Mother Nature, whatever you want to, however you want to define it. So understanding really who is the owner of all things will actually help you to really renounce things in truth. So therefore, a real yogi would see that I don't need to artificially renounce something. I need to use that thing, whatever it is, land or property, in the service of the divine, the real owner of that thing. You see? So, for example, if you had land, or if you had money, or if you had properties, you could use that in the service of God, in the service of, you know, for a higher purpose,
sure,
without serving your self-interest. And then that itself would be pure renunciation. So when I became a monk, I didn't have much to renounce anyway. So I joined an ashram in the mountains, and I lived very simply. And I embraced that, because it was just so much freedom to not have to worry about all these other things which we, you know, would stress us in the modern day life. And so I lived very simply. I slept on the floor. I didn't even have a pillow. I took cold showers. I rose at like 3:30 in the morning. And every morning we did meditation and study, and then during the day we worked on the farm, or we did some other service for the temple. And then in the evening again we do more study, or more, you know, kirtan, which is very popular now. People are talking about kirtan all over the world now. The yoga communities are really embracing that, but that's something that you know, I did over 30 years ago. It was just part of my daily life, and when back then it was considered to be quite weird. But yeah, so we do kirtan, and so we were always absorbed in using our senses in the service of God. We ate food which was first offered to God. We studied the philosophies of the Vedic culture. We try to connect everything in relation to Krishna, because ultimately everything is really connected to God. There's nothing but, you know, connection with God, but we're somehow or other, we've forgotten this connection. We think somehow we're separate from the divine. And I feel that that's part of the challenge and the the manipulation that's happening in the world today, that the ruling elite, they want people to think that they're separate. They want people to think that they're not connected to each other. And that's really a solution to a lot of problems when we understand that we are really all connected. We are individuals, but we're still all very connected energetically.
So, I mean, this sounds really, really far out there for a lot of people, you know, sleeping with no pillow, getting up at 3 a.m, all these things. But one thing that I'd love to hear your insight on is a guy like me hears that and it just sounds great. it sounds so great. You know, in the little time I have spent in ashrams, you know, probably a couple months of my life all in, I loved it. And I think I could do that really easily. My wife and my kids probably wouldn't be too happy, but I, you know, that sort of thing, it really, really appeals to me and my personality, you know, discipline and austerity, all that stuff. It just works for me. And I'm curious, you know, my wife attributes it to like a hyper masculine, not in any kind of derogatory way. That's just the way she pegs me. And I'm curious if you've noticed that when you were living this lifestyle, did it attract a wide variety of people, or was it the type A OCD people like me who, you know, are really, really pleased by an empty room with nothing in it?
Yeah, well, surprisingly, we did get a variety of people. There was quite a mix of characters in the ashram when I was a monk. Some of them were really eccentric. Some of them were like real macho men. Some of them were like very, you know, very simple and humble and soft, you know, in their nature. So there was a lot of, you had intellectuals, you had sportsmen type people. I mean, I was sort of a mix of all of those. I was a bit of a sporty guy, but I was also a philosopher. But I was also a very quiet person. So you really can't, externally, you can't judge who's going to like this, who's going to like fit into that sort of culture. But what I do know is that if someone's sincere about spiritual growth, then living simply really does help in that evolution. Because the way we lead our lives today, most people, they're very complex and there's a lot of distractions. And that sort of blocks us from being able to contemplate and being more conscious of our day-to-day activities and the blessings that surround us all the time. So going into the country, living simply, actually making time to just be quiet and listen to nature, to stop speaking, to, you know, to connect with Mother Earth and so on. All of these things are important for our not only spiritual but physical health as well. And so when I was living, you know, in that environment, I just embraced it. I just loved it because it was just so relieving. I remember the first time I shaved my head, I was like, I felt like I was reborn. It was amazing. I realized that old persona was now on the floor. My head was completely shaved, and I thought, my God, I'm a completely new person now, and I really felt like that. And of course, you know, physically I was still the same person, but inside the spirit was sort of speaking out, and I was realizing that I'm more than simply this body. There's much more to me than this body. And so by removing that past, you know, attachment to that physical identity, I'd helped to uncover a little bit of that spiritual spark which was been hidden for so long. And so through living simply, cultivating, being more contemplative, chanting mantras to purify the consciousness, eating pure foods, because food also plays a big part in purifying our consciousness. This often quoted maxim that you hear of, you know, you are what you eat. Mostly people apply that to the physical, in the physical sense, but really the food that you eat also affects your consciousness. And a lot of people are not really aware of that connection. And in fact, a very important part of the teachings of Krishna consciousness is that spirituality begins with the tongue, and that the tongue has two functions, tasting and vibrating. And so you can actually understand a lot about someone's consciousness by what they eat and by what they speak. So we learned the importance of controlling the tongue, and this is actually also very much an important teaching in the yoga tradition. When you control the tongue, you can actually control all the other senses. And of course, without controlling the senses, you can't have a controlled mind, and without a controlled mind, you can't have peace. And so all of this is important in being successful in yoga. And so that was the initial, you know, my initial experience with being a monk was to live simply. But then I started to learn this idea that, you know what, you can actually use things in God's service. You don't have to artificially renounce things. So then it was important for us to not just cut the world off, but to embrace things in the world, but purify them, use them in a positive way. And a classic example of this is like the knife in the hands of a villain can cause harm, but in the hands of a trained surgeon, it can save a life. So the knife is not bad and it's not good. It's how you use it. And the same applies to anything in this world. It's how you use it. What is the consciousness? What's the intention behind the use of that thing? And that's real renunciation.
So maybe we can jump back to your post-monk life, which sounds like you did exactly that. You started using these tools in a really powerful way of service. From what I understand, you've raised over $1 million for your work, and you've worked all around the world. And, you know, right now I'm talking to you, I believe you're in Colombia, and, you know, you're doing all kinds of things that sound very, very interesting. And so I'm curious, you know, what are the things that you're most worried about right now? What are the things you're most excited about right now, utilizing these tools that you've gathered?
We can see, you know, the internet is become a huge tool for connecting us. And in fact, this is another interesting phenomenon which is happening now with the internet and yoga. When we think of yoga, most people that have studied yoga understand that yoga means to unite, to connect with the divine. It comes from the Sanskrit word yuj, and it means to connect. So when you practice yoga, the idea is to connect mind, body, spirit, to connect with the higher consciousness, like this, to get in touch with your spirit. So with the internet, we're seeing a sort of a yoga phenomenon, because with this technology, it's enabling people from very diverse, very remote sort of locations to connect with each other. Now we have 7 billion people, and I think something like 6 billion people have phones. 2 billion people have access to the internet. It's quite amazing. So it's sort of like the yoga of the internet, so to speak. So that's sort of exciting in one aspect, but it's also scary. And we can see that in how social media and the internet sometimes has taken up too much of our time, or we've become a little bit impersonal, or we've become a little bit too dependent on the internet for our social interactions, and we've sort of lost touch with the personal touch, you know, the personal, the face-to-face sort of experiences, which are very important for our spiritual and mental development. So there's always a danger with everything. And but I'm excited in the fact that I can reach now so many people with this message using the internet, using these tools, and I can be in Bogota. I can be in, like last year I was in Haiti. And it's Haiti's like, it's, I've been to 65 countries, in my, you know, 50 years. I've traveled more than a lot of people, and I've seen a lot. I've been to 3 war zones, but I've been to some paradises too. So I've seen the good and the bad of this world. I've met with royalty. I've met with government officials, and I've made friends with, you know, people on the street and with the poorest people in the world. So Haiti's one of the poorest places in the world, and the people there are extremely desperate. It's just terrible to see it firsthand how much struggle these people have to make to just make ends meet. And yet I was connected on the internet in Haiti, in my little cabin. It was a very humble apartment, and I was connected to the internet and able to communicate with people all over the world. So that's really empowering. So I like that. But again, as I said, it's everything has to be done with balance. We can't allow these things to take over our lives, and we should never lose fact of the importance of the personal connection. That's really what nourishes our soul.
Great. So one last question is, you know, this whole plant-based thing, you know, for you, is it mostly health? Is it mostly spiritual? Is it environmental, or is it all of the above? I mean, you're feeding millions of people each year, and I'm curious, you know, how you view this lifestyle and this approach to eating and to feeding people.
Well, it's all of the above. Most people, I think, they become a vegetarian or a vegan for health reasons. I think the majority do that. And that's okay, but that should, you know, the way I see it now with my experience, I've been a vegetarian most of my life. I'm a vegan now. What really should motivate you is the moral aspect, the spiritual aspect, because until we understand the spiritual quality of all beings, we'll really miss out on understanding the essence of life. And so, for example, when you're eating that food, whatever that food is, whether it's even meat or a plant, that thing had a soul, has consciousness. And even the consciousness is not very developed, as in the case of a plant, but a plant does have consciousness, and that has been proven, in various scientific studies, that plants actually do respond to our feelings, even, not what to speak of sound. They actually respond to our feelings and mental thoughts. So everything has consciousness, and where there's consciousness, that's the presence of the soul. Consciousness is a symptom of a soul. So as long as, until we understand this spiritual connection, we really won't understand the essence of life itself. And so if you're just motivated by health reasons, that's okay, but it's not really complete. It won't satisfy you at the end of the day. And of course, if someone comes up with some medical research that just defeats all of your previous assumptions about health, then you could easily just go back to eating meat. And I've seen people do that, which is very sad. So I think it's important to have a spiritual approach to eating, to understand the importance of the spiritual connection in our spiritual, in our evolution using food. And in terms of eating plants, you know, of course, the argument is often made by people that are eating meat, oh, well, plants have feelings too. And the funny thing is like they'll only bring that up, you know, when you're challenging them, that all of a sudden they'll become, you know, conscious that plants have feelings. But before then, they don't even think about that. So, yes, plants do have feelings, but eating a plant is much less violent than cutting the throat of an animal. So we have to eat something, and it's best to take, the path of less violence. And that's really what a vegan diet or a vegetarian diet is. It's like you're trying to eat food without causing so much harm. Now, on top of that, even to be a vegetarian, however, is not perfect, or a vegan is not perfect. And this is something which, you know, is sort of challenging to especially the vegan community, because they think their diet is the best diet in the world. But if you simply take plants and eat them and not actually honor the source of those plants, that those plants are a blessing from a divine source, then in essence you're sort of stealing that food. So a yogi, a real yogi, understands the blessing of food and therefore takes it, first of all, asks permission to use that food, and then offers that food back to the divine. And that process of offering food is called making the food prasadam. Prasadam is a Sanskrit word. It means mercy, basically. And so a real yogi is not a vegan, not a vegetarian, but a real yogi is actually a prasadarian. And a prasadarian means one that will only eat food which has been blessed or karmically purified of any negativity.
It's an interesting thing. I'm a plant-based guy for a really long time, and you're right. You know, a lot of people think that they eat a vegan diet or a vegetarian diet and that they live cruelty-free, but the world is so much more complex than that, and it gets more and more complex every day, and the cycle of life is not something that you can't just step out of completely, you know? And so, you know, you have your California-grown vegan kale that was grown on fish mulch, because organic laws stipulate that you can't use, petroleum, which is basically second generation dinosaurs. And so, the cycle of life is here, whether you like it or not. And so I think what you said is really insightful, is that, you know, you have to be conscious of everything that you do, because there's no perfect anything. And we're all participating, whether we like it or not, in this food system, in this world system, in this energy exchange. And food just happens to be this obligatory participation that happens two or three times a day.
Yeah, unless you're some really advanced yogi that doesn't need to eat food. And that's like, you know, 0.00000% of the population. You know, we all have to eat food. So yeah, it's best to eat food which is causing the least amount of violence. And the fact is, even as a vegan, you can't avoid violence, because when you drive a car, you know there's animal fats in the tires and so on. So a real yogi is someone that understands those challenges and therefore offers the food in sacrifice, which is a very ancient tradition in India, you know, where people offer their food. It's very common. This is what distinguishes the difference between the Vedic culture and, say, the Christianity, whereby most Christians will, offer thanks at the table in the form of grace. But if we take it a step further and understand that this food is a blessing, and therefore we actually prepare the food in such a way that it is for the pleasure of God, then you're taking your eating to the next level, to the real spiritual level, because then preparing food becomes a type of service or a way to connect with God. And that's an interesting part of the Food for Life program, and that all of our cooks, when they prepare the food, they don't taste any of the food before they actually serve it to the children. It's all prepared in a very pristine environment, and the consciousness of the cooks is that this is actually an offering we're going to make to God first, and so they'll actually say a little prayer and ask the divine to please taste this food before they then put the food in containers and then serve it to the children at the school. So it's very, very special. So there's a beautiful consciousness put into the food as well. So then the kids are getting nourishment for their spirit.
Paul, I've loved this conversation. I think we could talk all day, but we need to wrap up here. So for people listening who would like to learn more about you, more about your work, more about your charitable work, what is the best way for them to reach you?
You can reach me two ways. One is on the Food for Life website. So it's foodforlife.org or ffl.org, and not .com. .com actually takes you to a bakery, which is a nice bakery, but foodforlife.org is the charity. And for me personally, with my work with food yoga, foodyogi.org. So I'm known as the food yogi because I'm teaching people about the spiritual connection of food, the importance of food on the spiritual evolution. So it's foodyogi.org.
Perfect. Well, thanks so much for your time. Thanks for sharing your experiences with us. And Paul, someday I'm going to come to Mumbai and I'm going to see that, I'm going to see that little kitchen cranking out 60,000 meals a day. I got to see that.
Oh, you got to see it, man. It's amazing.
I do. I can't wait. Well, thanks so much. Have a great day, and I hope to talk to you again very, very soon. You've got questions, we've got answers. Welcome to the FAQ round. If you've got something you'd like to ask, please send it in to podcast@yogabodynaturals.com. Now, let's hear what's going on with our listeners. We've got some great questions from students this week. The first question is from Kelly. Kelly says, how do you properly maintain the yoga trapeze? Do you have to wash it? If so, what are the washing instructions? This is a very technical question, but we'll just jump into this really quickly. Yoga trapeze, for those of you who don't know who are listening, is our yoga inversion tool. It's really great for pulling motions, for passive back bends. You can search it online. We got a ton of photos, and we got them in our studios. We're doing a lot of stuff with it. It's a lot of fun. In terms of care for it, unless you're sweating all over it, don't do anything. If you are sweating all over it, hand wash it in cold water, hang it to dry. The material is very, very durable, but I wouldn't put it in a heated dryer, and I wouldn't use hot water. Barbara asks, I loved your pumpkin cream recipe, but what exactly is oat cream? I've heard of it, and I don't know where to buy it. So oat cream is something you can make. You can make it by adding cooked oats and water and blending it up in a blender, or you can buy it from a store. Oat cream tends to be pretty high in starch. It's kind of a starchy food, and so I wouldn't recommend using it a lot, but it can be a nice one to incorporate into dishes you're trying to make creamy without using dairy. If it comes in a little carton, that's probably about 200 milliliters, which you'll see in the cooler section. Kelly says, I have abdominal drains. Will the yoga trapeze interfere with them or cause me damage if I use it? Kelly, for sure, I wouldn't do anything without talking to your doctor. Sounds like you probably don't want to be inverted, but again, I don't know where you're at in that healing process. James says, I can't handle eating a whole pineapple a day and take bromelain supplements instead. Would you recommend I keep taking them? Yeah, that's great. Great question. You may have read on my blog, I ate an entire pineapple every day, literally every day for about 5 years. I couldn't get enough of it. I still like it, but I don't love it the way I used to. I don't know what happened, but for 5 years, literally, I wanted it every single day. And I would, when I lived in New York, I would have to ride my bike all over the city trying to find some deli that had a pineapple. There's an interesting enzyme called bromelain, and it's very anti-inflammatory, and it's really great for sore muscles. Not surprising when you're doing a lot of yoga, it can be really helpful. As a supplement, it's very safe. Enzymes are very, very safe and very simple to take. If it's working for you, James, I'd keep taking it. Yeah, don't worry about it at all. Hope that's helpful. If you too have questions, email them in to podcast@yogabodynaturals.com. The food you eat affects your body and mind every day. Welcome to the Nutritional Tip of the Week, where we explore plant-based diets, superfood nutrition, edible insects, and nootropics. The goal here is mind-body biohacking for a better you and a better planet. So hey, let's talk nutrition. Today's nutritional tip of the day is all about coriander, also called cilantro, depending on what part of the world you're in. Cilantro or coriander can look similar to flat parsley. It can also look kind of clover-like in its look. It has a very distinct smell. It's both loved and hated. It's a key part of lots and lots of different cuisines. Mexican cuisine, it's very prominent in Mexican salsas. It's often served raw on top of lots of Mexican dishes. But you'll find it in almost every cuisine all over the world. You'll find it in Indian cooking, primarily the seeds, coriander or cilantro seeds. You'll find it in different curries and sambar and lots of different things. Let's talk specifically about the leaves. The thing I like about coriander is it's just about as ubiquitous as parsley, meaning you can find it just about everywhere. It's one of these really powerful superfoods, really amazing healing properties. A lot of your herbs have very, very high density of healing properties, primarily micronutrients. It's antimicrobial, it's antibacterial. It's a really, really potent cleanser for your body. It's also been shown to have a really interesting effect on cholesterol, increasing good cholesterol and decreasing bad cholesterol, and balancing your triglyceride levels. And also, it's been used in the treatment of type 2 diabetes. Now, the studies are kind of ambiguous in terms of what it does. Does it increase insulin sensitivity? Does it have insulin-like properties? It's kind of unclear, but it seems to have really clear health benefits. Lots of different benefits. The other more interesting things that people talk a lot about coriander for is its chelation properties. Chelation is when something you eat binds with minerals in your body. In this specific case, coriander is often used for binding, for chelating lead. So we get lead from things in our environment, environmental toxins, paints, old residue. Even though all this stuff is illegal, like lead and paints, there's still a lot of lead around. And coriander is really powerful for chelation. People will take lots of coriander to chelate other minerals like mercury from their body if they have silver amalgam fillings and things like that. In any case, coriander is very easy to use. There's a certain percentage of people who find it absolutely disgusting and it tastes like soap. There's actually some people are allergic to it. It might be those same people. I'm not sure. For other people, when served with lemon or lime, it's pretty much the most delicious spice ever. And so the most delicious herb, I should say. As a spice, it's delicious as well. How to use it. You can use it on top of a fresh salad. It's often used raw, sliced up leaves on top of a thick soup, a curry, and mixed in with any kind of rice dish. For sure, raw, you're going to get more of the antioxidant properties. I like to put it in juice, a really unique juice. At the restaurant we used to serve called Happy Belly, we made pineapple juice mixed with coriander, which sounds disgusting, but it's absolutely delicious, and you get that raw, pure coriander. It's surprisingly mellow as well. You can take about half a head of coriander and juice it, and it's really, really effective. So I'd encourage you to incorporate coriander into more of your foods. Use it as a garnish. Use it with lemon or lime. Very, very strong flavor and very healthful for you as well. You've been listening to the Yoga Talk Show with Lucas Rockwood. If you like this show, I always appreciate reviews and ratings on the iTunes Store. It helps other listeners find out about what we're doing, and it keeps me motivated to dig around and find new and diverse topics to share with you. For complete show notes, links to everything discussed in the show, along with a ton of other free yoga videos and online resources, please head over to yogabodynaturals.com. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk to you very soon.